Welcome to episode number 118 of the Great Northwest Winecast. I'm Andy Perdue, editor and publisher of Great Northwest Wine and wine columnist for the Seattle Times. Adam Campbell grew up in the heart of the Oregon wine industry, where his parents founded Elk Cove Vineyards in the Yamhill County town of Gaston. For more than a decade, Adam has been at the helm of the family business and has focused on producing more and more of his wines using only estate grapes. We recently sat down with Adam during the International Pinot Noir celebration in McMinnville to talk about his family's winery. Here's the interview. I'm in the heart of Oregon wine country. I'm with Adam Campbell, second-generation winemaker, Elk Cove Vineyards. Your family history goes back to the early 70s, and you've been making the wine for the last 20 years. Welcome to the Great Northwest Winecast.
Oh, thanks for having me.
So give me a little bit of history. Where did your parents come from when they decided to go to Gaston to plant wine grapes?
Well, they certainly traveled a lot and lived in California near wine country in kind of the college years. But they're actually native Oregonians from the Hood River Valley area. My grandfather was a pear farmer up in Parkdale, Oregon, at the base of Mount Hood, and so real farming background. And they just became enamored with wine and had heard rumors of some Pinot plantings happening in the Willamette Valley and came here to check it out and bought a abandoned prune orchard and set up shop.
And so were you born in Portland? Were you born in Hood River? Where'd you come into the world at?
I was actually born in South Dakota on the Pine Ridge Indian Reservation. My father was a physician by training, and he was drafted into the military, and instead of going to Vietnam, they sent him to Pine Ridge, South Dakota.
I'll probably offend somebody by saying I'm not sure which one is the third world country, but he did end up in Oregon. Now, how cool is it to grow? I mean, you were a little kid when your parents started this, and you got to grow up around Dickie Rath and David Lett and David Adelsheim, and you were part of that group as they were creating this industry. And, you know, maybe when you were a kid you didn't realize it, but I mean, how cool is that you witnessed all this history happening?
Yeah, I think from my memory, those were just my parents' crazy friends, and they'd get together and drink wines from around the world, get inspired, passionately debate and talk about how to make this thing happen in Oregon. And you know, my brothers and sisters and I, sometimes we get tired of our parents just talking about Pinot Noir wine all the time, but those are the conversations that I think really inform a lot of what I do today, and in that you learn from your parents, you learn from their successes, but maybe you learn more from actually their mistakes and what they did. And I think the one thing that I have in complete common with my parents is a real passion for wine.
Now, did you grow up with some of these other kids who are now winemakers? I'm thinking specifically like Luisa Ponzi and some of these other second generation winemakers who've come into being in Oregon.
Yeah, we certainly would run around each other. Probably for me, the boys more Jason Lett and the Sokol Blosser brothers. They're kind of part of my group at different wine events that we'd run around together. Luis is actually one of my closest friends now, but we didn't know each other that much growing up. Maybe it was the gender thing or just being a little bit farther apart in terms of where our wineries are.
Right. She told me once that when she became a teenager, she became horribly embarrassed by the fact that her last name was on, you know, tens of thousands of bottles of wine. You didn't have to deal with that because they didn't name it Campbell Winery.
Yeah, I think that's true. It maybe took a little pressure off. But I do remember as a kid, you know, I just went to the local farming school, Yamhill, Carlton. You know, all my friends' parents farmed as well. But I think I learned somewhere in fourth or fifth grade that my parents were pretty alternative in what they were choosing to do, and it was definitely thought of as a weird thing that was not going to work out. And it's funny now because Yamhill Carlton, the high school now, has a ag program based on viticulture. It's got a demonstration vineyard on campus, and I went from being really the only kid in the parents in the wine industry to that's a big part of that school now.
Yeah, that's for sure. When did you come to the realization that you wanted to join the family business?
Well, I, you know, like my brothers and sisters and like a lot of second generation Oregon kids, we thought of it coming back to the business. I think we just thought of it as a lot of hard work. It was definitely our parents' dream and what they and all their crazy friends were passionate about. And it's really hard to imagine doing what your parents to follow in their footsteps when you're 18 or 19. So I have a degree in political science. I went to Lewis and Clark College and got a great liberal arts degree and spent a year in Australia. And that's when I really started missing the vineyards and where I grew up. And when I was fortunate enough to have my wife come join me, she's from Australia. She came back and I said to her when we were coming back, I said, I really want to do this. And I didn't know what aspect of it. I knew it had to do with the grapes. I didn't know it would be winemaking, but I initially just started, managing the vineyards. But once you put all that love into managing vineyards, then you want to take it to the next step too.
And I've got to think your folks had to be thrilled when they saw you coming back into the business on your own accord, not being forced into it. And now, really taking over this family business and making it yours, your vision in addition to their vision.
Yeah, I think, they spent, 27 years before I came back and at this. And I think compared to today, back then, it was really a lot of hard work. And they were kind of done with it, I think, by the time I decided to come back. And they were super happy to have fresh energy and to see that I was passionate about wine, passionate about being entrepreneurial in terms of not just doing what they do and continuing the business, but really to expand it and make it, what their vision was and a combined vision.
One of the, I would call it an evolution in the Oregon wine industry, I think it's really happened, it seems to have taken shape in the last 5 or 6 years, is vineyard sourcing and vineyard ownership. In Washington, most wineries don't own any vines. They buy all their grapes. It seems increasingly in Oregon that if you want to secure your grape sources, you better own it. And you've taken that to heart, and that's become a big part of your philosophy.
Yeah, I feel really fortunate that, we had a farming background. I'm a fifth-generation Oregon farmer. My great-grandfather was a immigrant from Switzerland and was a dairy farmer. And then, so all through the generations, I think we have a real kind of a feel for it. When I came back and took over from my parents, we just had our 40 acres on the estate property, and we were buying a lot of fruit because at the time we wanted to grow our business, but that's all we could afford to plant is 40 acres. And, working with my parents and working closely with our banking friends and lenders, we were able to secure financing for some really exciting vineyard projects, both planted vineyards like at our Five Mountain property and Clay Court, Goodrich, Windhill, but also a bunch of bare ground, hillside vineyards that I could jump in. And we're farming 350 acres. Elk Cove, our primary winery, is going to be 100% estate grown, starting with the 2016 vintage, and we're super excited about that.
So you will be reliant on nobody but yourself for every grape you use.
Yeah, and I think, with new projects coming in all the time and vineyard sources getting purchased by other people, it's important, but it's also kind of a respect for the fact that over the years, we feel like we do really good quality viticulture. We know what to do. We know where to plant vineyards. We know the soils we like. And the highest quality fruit we can get is our estate fruit. And, at the end of the day, there's no one to either blame or get the credit except yourself.
Well, and I think it probably lends itself to a certain precision in winemaking when you know exactly what you're going to get and you're in complete control of that. And you can say, I'm going to drop this fruit because I need the quality, and you don't have to think quite so much about the farmer's perspective of it, because you are the farmer.
Oh, yeah. I mean, one of the, you know, we were 2 years ago, we planted this interesting Dijon clone that, you know, it's renowned for only setting 1 ton an acre. And I mean, I wouldn't plant my whole vineyard with it, but I could plant 5 acres of it because I'm interested in it. And I couldn't ask an independent grower to do that. You can't get 1 ton an acre and be financially solvent unless you take that wine, turn it into a finished product. And if it, you know, it's part of my exploration. I don't know if it's going to be better than our other clones. You know, we'll find out, I guess, 15, 20 years from now. And if it really only sets 1 ton an acre, I can handle that.
Yeah, interesting. You're not just about Pinot Noir. You make a lot of Pinot Noirs, different price ranges from affordable to collectible, I guess is what we'd call it. One of your most fascinating wines to me is your Pinot Gris. You make a lot of that. My take on it over the last 10 years is that your Pinot Gris exemplifies what Oregon can achieve with that grape. Tell me some of your secrets, if you will, about your development of that grape and how you've created this wine at fairly large volumes now to be so delicious and so precise. And so, Oregon, if you will.
Yeah, you know, we're obviously super passionate about Pinot Noir, and so a lot of my energy in terms of experimentation and pushing the envelope does focus on Pinot Noir, but we're also almost equally focused on white varieties, especially Alsatian varietals. I spent a summer after working a couple harvests with my father. We had a great exchange with a family from Alsace, and the son worked for us for 3 months, and I spent a summer over there. And I really was enamored with those wines. I loved the people and their passion for white wine. They have Pinot Noir in Alsace as well, but when they talk passionately about wine, it was a lot about Pinot Gris and also about Riesling and Gewürztraminer and these other varieties. Pinot Gris for us, we've started planting it back in the early 80s, and it just does really well. It ripens alongside Pinot Noir. We basically farm it the same way. I have almost 100 acres on various sites, and I love that kind of freshness and vitality that you can get from a aromatic white wine with great brightness. And it also helps that, you know, we our preferred style is to make it in stainless steel to capture the fruit and the freshness and that kind of stone fruit mineral quality, but that also allows us to have nice restaurant support by the glass. It's definitely a friendlier price point than Pinot Noir, which is just expensive to grow and produce.
Yeah. Well, and for me, when I open a bottle of Elk Cove Pinot Gris, it's, to me, just smelling it reminds me of how fun it would be to enjoy that at the beach or to enjoy it in a coastal setting or a water setting with a plate of scallops or oysters or clams or something like that. Really shouts Northwest to me as much as any wine that I drink.
Yeah, one of my favorite pairings for Pinot Gris is actually the same pairing I would recommend for Pinot Noir, especially lighter, you know, more, red-fruited Pinot Noir is grilled salmon with a little smokiness from the grill. Salmon and Pinot Gris go equally well together as it would with Pinot Noir. And, you know, we do a lot of work to on that with Pinot Gris to really kind of capture the fruit, capture the freshness, have it be something you want to have a second glass of.
And I'm guessing this connection that you have with Alsace influences the fact that you make terrific Riesling, beautiful Pinot Blanc, which is also an Alsatian variety. I'm guessing that's been a lot of that influence.
Yeah, definitely. You know, those are wines that I love to drink. I don't think, you know, in Oregon, our climate's not the same as Alsace, and we don't try to emulate it. It's definitely an Oregonian take on those varieties, but it's you know, I have a real reverence for what they do, not only there, but also in the northern Italian areas, too. Those are beautiful wines as well. I think these are, you know, classic grape varieties that if you take good quality fruit from great vineyards and treat it with respect and really passionately focus on it, you can make amazing fresh white wines from Oregon.
Yeah, and Riesling, I think there's a real excitement that's growing for Riesling from Oregon. You know, maybe the real tragedy for Oregon Riesling is the fact that it's difficult to plant Riesling when you can make so much more. A farmer can make so much more money by planting Pinot Noir, and it's not always easy to grow, especially in a cooler season.
Yeah, probably, especially for Riesling, but even for other white varieties. I think if you're going to really make these wines, white wines from Oregon, you can't rely on other people planting grapes for you. We are fortunate. We've got some really great old vines that my parents planted. I've recently planted some new Riesling vines just because I know those 45-year-old vines won't last forever, and we want to have old Riesling vines forever and ever. I love those wines. They, especially the old vines, they smaller crops and really intense flavors that you can make quite a dry style Riesling, but with so much complexity and aromatics.
Yeah, and I think a lot of people don't realize just how ageable Oregon wines, especially Pinot Noir, are. I texted you a photo a few weeks ago. I think it was it a 2000 Pinot Noir. It was from some friends. They had their wedding at your winery. I guess you guys do a lot of weddings. And they had this bottle that I think their folks had brought, so we all opened it. And it was so gorgeous, I had to text it to you.
Yeah, we love seeing that. And you know, people are surprised by the ageability of the Oregon Pinot Noirs, Oregon Rieslings as well, and Chardonnays as well. I mean, I think when you have wines from cooler regions, carefully made, it's amazing how they really evolve and change into something that's even up to 10 years old, they still have some primary fruit, but they're mostly just amazingly complex and long on the palate.
Where can people find your wines, particularly in Washington and maybe even the Seattle area? Are you pretty well distributed there?
Yeah, nice retailers up there in Seattle and Tacoma area have them. We've been fortunate to be in a lot of nice restaurants. I always say if they don't have it at your local wine shop, the best thing for us is to, sometimes people say, oh, you want me to buy it direct from you. It's like, well, that's fine. But the best thing is if people go into their local wine shop with a person they trust and say, I love Elk Cove wine. Can you get me some? And, what a great, testimonial to that, retailer that they want to have the Elk Cove Mount Richmond Pinot Noir or one of my white wines. Yeah, we love that.
And for people who want to come visit, Gaston is not necessarily on the beaten path, but it's not necessarily off anymore. There's more than one winery in Gaston, and getting there from Portland is what, about 45 minutes or so?
Yeah, it's a great first stop or last stop, I guess. You can head out Highway 26 from Portland as you're heading towards the coast, take a little detour to the south, towards Yamhill, Carlton, McMinnville, and you really can, it's a beautiful property. We have 200 acres there that we're happy to host people on. We've had a tasting room there since 1981, and just every year hosts thousands of people, but it's always a personal experience when people come up. You'll often find me wandering around the back bottling, or my mom still does all our gardening. She's often out front, and we always love to post people there because that's where we can really tell our story, and you can see the history, and we've got, definitely encourage people to come visit us.
And they can see elk too, right?
Yeah, certainly not right on our property because we've deer fenced to keep the pesky buggers out of the vines during the growing season. But I still see the same herd that I saw as a kid, that came and spent a winter with us that first year when we lived in a trailer. I see them on the lower sections of our 200 acres and in the canyons. And if they come up, there's lots of wildlife.
All right. Well, thanks for joining us on the Great Northwest Winecast.
Thanks, Andy. Happy to.
I hope you enjoyed this interview with Adam Campbell. To learn more, go to www.elkcove.com. Thank you for taking the time to listen to the Great Northwest Winecast. If you enjoy what we're doing, please take a moment to leave an honest rating and review on iTunes. It doesn't take much time, and it means a lot to us. We'll talk to you again next week in another episode of the Great Northwest Winecast. Take care.